Hi.
Whoa, your camera's falling. Camera's falling.
Gorilla pod?
That's the problem. Okay. You're trusting a gorilla pod. You need a Kong pod.
Kong pod?
Kong.
Oh.
King of the Apes.
That's a play on words as well as a reference to movies.
Welcome to Movied, guys.
That right there is the intro.
Movied!
Today we're talking about Mank.
Mank.
I could do the synopsis this time.
Oh, great. Mank. Yeah.
The 11th film by David Fincher about the writing of the movie Citizen Kane. It was written, well, there's debate, but it was co-written by Orson Welles and his name, besides Mank.
Herman Mankiewicz.
Herman Mankiewicz. Herman J. Mankiewicz, right? Basically, it is about Mank, who is bedridden because of an accident, writing Citizen Kane while it flashes back to various points in his life as a writer in old Hollywood.
And as a part of kind of the social circle of...
That guy.
This is embarrassing. Citizen Kane is about Charles Foster Kane, is his name in the movie.
Why is it escaping me, too?
Yeah.
It is...
Hearst. William Randolph Hearst.
Dang, you got it.
Yes.
You got Hearst first. Basically, Herman J. Mankiewicz was a part of the social circle of William Randolph Hearst, who was a big-time millionaire, maybe billionaire, media mogul, magnate. He owned a newspaper, kind of running Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, and kind of like politics as well, or a certain segment of California politics, at least, is implied heavily in this movie, at least. And hey, I always believe everything I see in movies, so.
Sure.
You know?
Totally. They're all documentaries.
True. Yeah, basically. Yeah. So that's a great synopsis, Craig. It very much that movie.
Would you recommend Mank to people?
I'd recommend Mank. Yeah, sure. Would you?
Well, ask me.
Craig, would you recommend the movie Mank?
I've prepared this line. Mank is grank, meaning it's great. I would recommend it to everyone. But out of those people I recommend it to, I think many of them would not be interested because they don't care about writing, they don't care about film history, or Citizen Kane.
Do they care about beautifully photographed cinema?
Yeah, I guess that's a draw.
It's styled as a classic Hollywood picture from like the late 30s, early 40s. It's not just like looking like it. It is made to be it. We're not going to allude to those things. We're just going to be a classic Hollywood movie.
It to the point where the audio sounded like old audio.
Yeah. They didn't shoot it on film. They shot it digitally as all of Fincher's movies have been since, probably Curious Case at least, which I haven't seen, by the way.
Is that the only one of his you haven't seen?
Yeah, that's the only one.
And you refuse to for some reason.
I just don't feel like, I just never feel like it. Like, Fincher, for me, has like a vibe I want from Fincher and a certain amount of cynicism. And nothing about Curious Case looks like it's trying to be that other thing.
It's a recipe for a ton of depression. Because it's like, it's a guy who starts out super old and he's destined to gradually become a baby and then...
I hear you. No, and I've heard people talk about how weird it is and like that it's as well done. Of course it's well done. It's a David Fincher movie. There's kind of a wry smirk to a lot of David Fincher's work that I just suspect is not in the golden-hued cards for Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
I liked it. I've only seen it once a while ago. To me, the weirdness was the computer-animated old man.
Starting with Fight Club, all those computer-generated things look really good because they're just... They're not organic material. You know, he's going through apartments and refrigerators and through the stove and all this stuff. And like the through the brain stuff looks very CGE because it's CGE. And when you come out of Edward Norton's face, you kind of feel CGE in a way that the other non-organic stuff doesn't bump you quite as much. And it's just a matter of us being far enough away from that technology.
We get used to effects and then they get better. And then we notice when they're not. It's like... You need an A-B comparison.
And that's why practical will always reign. Did you see in Once Upon a Time in Mexico, Robert Rodriguez's third in the Desperado trilogy?
I think I did, but I don't remember it.
He does all kinds of stuff where like he takes the actor, he lays the actor down, but they've made a fake head of the actor. So as the actor's laying there, they pull off the eye patch and there's a bag of cocaine in his eye socket, right? And so like you pull the bag of cocaine out of the eye socket and it looks so real because he has the actor's face there and he's only taken the one eye socket out, but it goes into the like the prosthetic that they've made of the face. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's how you do it.
But also in Benjamin Button, to defend him a little, like an old man who's just born, what would that look like? how would you make that look?
Gollum. So as we got into this whole, like where we were coming from was in the very beginning of the movie, they have the full opening credits, like classic Hollywood films do. And they're long, like it's cars driving through the desert, going to whatever writer's retreat he's going to.
Old timey music,
old timey cards coming up. The scroll was beautiful.
It moves kind of slowly in that there'll be long scenes, but really fast dialogue, like a lot of dialogue. And I actually had to turn on subtitles. Like, cause I went back a few times. Like I was watching, I'm like, I kind of got it. And I'm like, well, a couple times it was like, cause I missed something, but sometimes it was like, that was so great. I want to see that again. So I went back and like, listened to the dialogue again. I think we should move into spoilers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's great too. There's also not a ton of worry about spoilers in this one. Like the plot points aren't going to rock your world or anything. It's all about watching like characters interact. And
well, they reveal that William Randolph Hearst is an alien.
No, Craig, that's not true.
Okay.
But welcome to spoilers territory, guys.
Yeah, we're in spoilers now. That's the indication.
So, Craig, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't take notes other than the mental notes that I have just in my head from watching a film.
Okay. I have notes. Again.
I think I'm going to say this one thing, and then I think we should just go through your notes again, because that's a blast. Kay. That's a great way to go through these things. Oftentimes, when a director is kind of hearkening back to an old Hollywood vibe, it's so dependent on the actors being able to actually do it. And it doesn't matter if they're buying in as hard as they can. If it's an actor who could not exist in that time, it just stands out like a sore thumb. And I'm thinking, when I say this, I'm thinking about The Great and Powerful Oz, the Sam Raimi movie that came out not that long ago.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, so it was styled very much like a classic Hollywood movie. It's like starts in 4-3 ratio, and the cast was James Franco.
I see where you're going with that, though. James Franco is very much a person of now.
He is now, and he was trying to be old-timey and everything, but it just seemed so false. Same with, she played the Wicked Witch of the West in it, and she's so good. She was in that 70s show. She's married to Ashton Kutcher. Bad Moms Christmas.
Oh, Mila Kunis?
Mila Kunis. So she was the Wicked Witch of the West. And come on, like...
She's a person of now.
She is now. Like, her saying those old lines, it just felt like Mila Kunis pretending to be old-timey. And they were going they were going for it, man. It just, you couldn't sell that. Whereas Gary Oldman, Amanda Seyfried, Lily Collins, like, the people in this movie, whoever played Orson Welles, he was great. Like, the people in this movie...
Daddy Lannister from Game of Thrones is William Randolph Hearst. Yeah, he was the perfect choice.
He was fantastic. Like, they all feel old-timey. They feel of that time... But not of that time for real, of that time in a movie.
It's a movie mostly for film snobs and film buffs. I really don't think this movie is for everybody. I personally think it's a beautiful masterpiece, work of art. But I think it's not for everybody. But I also, after reading about it later, like, I have mixed feelings about how inaccurate a lot of it is.
I would love to hear about some of those inaccuracies, too. Do you have those written down, or...
I don't have those written down, but I can remember. I remember some.
All right, what are they?
Like, you didn't read anything about it?
I read very, very little about it. The thing that intrigued me the most is that it was the one remaining unproduced feature written by David Fincher's father, Jack Fincher, who worked for the San Francisco Chronicle forever.
I don't mind if some things are inaccurate. Like, obviously, it's condensed to fit into his life.
They
even say that in the movie, basically.
Yeah.
They allude to that. The guy who makes the propaganda film...
Yeah.
And then suicide?
I did read this. Yeah, go ahead.
He didn't exist. It was someone else who made the propaganda film.
Yeah. The guy who did make the political propaganda film also then saw a very successful career follow making that film. He didn't kill himself.
Right. But that was a way to serve showing how Mank or how for Upton Sinclair he was and how against William Randolph Hearst and Louis B. Mayer he was.
Yeah.
That's not even also really accurate. Like it seems as though he was more center right than he was left, that the movie makes him out to be.
Oh, okay.
Also, it makes it seem as if he basically was the sole writer of Citizen Kane and Orson Welles stole it from him. There is no real conclusive evidence that he's like the only, like, subsequent drafts and rewrites happened after he gave it to Orson Welles.
Yeah.
It was like there was more process to it than they made it seem.
Yeah, no, of course. And I also the one thing I read about it came from Amy Nicholson. He handed him like a 300-page screenplay, and from there it was time for Orson to kind of whittle it down and make it a movie.
Yeah, I feel like there's still a lot more work to be done
after
you get a 300-page script. That said, like, without Mank, the movie wouldn't exist as it is.
100%. Like, I mean, to me, it sounds like a co-writing situation. And I mean, it sounds like I believe 100% that the entire first draft would be Mank. And then Orson would take it from there. But that doesn't mean Orson Welles didn't do anything to it.
Right.
Yeah.
It kind of makes it seem like he was just like the bad guy who took it. And then, I mean, in some ways he was kind of, he was kind of arrogant and egotistical in that he didn't want Mank to take credit, any credit. And but I don't know.
We're also seeing it through all of these events, through the lens of Mankiewicz. Like, we're seeing it from his perspective. While factually inaccurate, it's probably how Welles seemed to him.
I take more issue with the politics. Like,
sure.
I feel like that was a kind of the core of the movie, is like his left-leaning politics and being against.
Well, it's Kurtz. Like the whole an extended second act is about that.
Obviously, he is against Hearst in some ways, because he wrote the script about him, but I don't think it was just about politics, because he wasn't that far removed from from Hearst's politics.
Sure.
So. I don't know. But how do you feel about Citizen Kane?
Citizen Kane, I respect a bunch, and I understand how many things evolved from it, like how many techniques were pioneered in it. That being said, sitting down and watching Citizen Kane, I am bored by. I get bored. I get bored watching it.
I haven't watched it in a while, but I've seen it like four or five times, and I love it.
Yeah, I've seen it at least three times.
The more times I watch it, the more I like it. All right. Should I go to my notes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, one other thing before I forget.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway through the movie, I was like, his little brother Joe, who comes to Hollywood, he's bringing into the studio his little brother Joe. Joe Mankiewicz? Joseph L. Mankiewicz? Is that who we're talking about here? And I couldn't believe, so I had to look it up immediately. And they were brothers. The guy who wrote and directed All About Eve and People Will Talk. Just Joseph L. Mankiewicz is awesome. Awesome writer director who I've seen way more of his work than Herman's.
Well, Mank, our Mank, our hero Mank, was apparently like deeply a part of Hollywood for a long time.
Yeah,
and was like a writer, a rewriter.
But I was unfamiliar with his name, but I knew by heart the name Joseph L. Mankiewicz.
Yeah, well, because he was a director too. So
yeah, that helps.
Yeah, because who cares about writers?
Am I right? Right?
Ugh. Whoa! No. Mank notes. That's the first thing I wrote.
Uh-huh.
Opening credits make me giddy. I wrote that.
They're fantastic. They're fantastic.
I feel like that would have launched a discussion about the opening credits, but we already talked about them. So, now brace yourself. I'm going to swear here.
Oh.
I wrote, camera angles are perfect. Fucking Fincher, man. That's what I wrote.
Yeah.
Just from the opening scene, all the camera angles, I think, or most of them, are just like low angle by his bed looking up. Like, it's like, it's just, it's really putting you in his point of view.
Yeah.
And it's just real good.
Yeah.
And then I think that I wrote several just lines of dialogue, because there's so many good ones. It moves like a bullet. And sometimes there's some things I went back and re-listened to and still don't get. Like, I couldn't figure out what they meant.
What?
I looked at the subtitles. What's that?
Well, like what? Do you have an example?
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But I wrote, nothing like a good noodle. That was a line. And then I wrote, Orson Welles' goatee. I wrote that.
Yeah.
Because that goatee was real goatee-like. And then I wrote, feels like you need lots of prior knowledge to appreciate this, which is what we said in the previous episode.
I also don't think that's entirely true. Like, if you go in the spirit of like, I'm going to watch an old movie now that's made today, but I'm going to watch an old movie. Like, I don't know that you need a bunch of prior knowledge. I think it could function just as like, here's this writer. He was part of this society.
There's a lot of passing lines of dialogue referring to people, like characters in the movie, Hearst or Louis B. Mayer, like Upton Sinclair. They're just like lines of dialogue that they just breeze by. And I feel like it would be really confusing and you might not care what they're talking about if because they don't explain it. No.
They speak as characters within the world who already know what they're talking about, which is great.
Yeah.
I love when they do that. I didn't know who a bunch of the people were before this. Yeah. I didn't know who Herman J. Mankiewicz was. I knew the name William Randolph Hearst. I knew he lived at Said Sibian. I didn't know the name of his trophy wife.
Yeah.
Hollywood trophy wife, who I'm now blanking on again, played by Amanda Seyfried.
I didn't know who that was either, but...
I didn't know who Upton Sinclair was. I didn't know, who the Republican challenger was. I didn't know any of those things, but I felt, included.
Yeah, well, good. Oh, you're also a guy who loves writing in movies, and you love making movies. So
I also love, they don't explain a lot of things that, would seem to require explanation. Like, when the first time we go into that writer's room on the studio, there is a naked woman typing in the corner wearing just burlesque pasties. Yeah. And they never explain her presence.
No. I mean, I don't feel like you needed prior knowledge for that, though. That was just what's going on? But I feel like there are a lot of people who would be lost, who would lose because they're not interested in the making of a movie they've never seen, making of movies in general,
I gotta say, you've been saying the word making a lot, like making me giddy, making movies. And every time you do, I want to say manking. And it's just really hard for me not. I had to get it
please
out. Do, I had to say
please
it once.
Say manking every time I say making. And then I wrote, this is old Hollywood and it's about writing. Jake will love this. Am I right? Am I right about that?
Yeah.
You love old Hollywood, right?
I love old Hollywood, and anytime we see people walking through a Hollywood backlot, I just feel so happy. It doesn't matter what era it is, what anything. Seeing people walking between sound stages, they always have a bunch of ridiculous jibber jabber running in front of them. Somebody's in an alien costume, somebody's in a cowboy costume. They're just whatever Hollywood tropes from the early 40s can be. They have them running around in the foreground, but just seeing sound stages makes me
happy. I like that too. I like that stuff too. I don't know if I love it as much as you do, but I love it too.
Even though I was making $0, one of the happiest times ever, I was just working at the backlot, backdraft attraction on the Universal Studios California lot. And the backdraft attraction is butted right up against the backlot. Mm-hmm. So we were right next to, I could go back and have my lunch across from sound stages.
Awesome.
And it was the greatest. The only thing I can remember that filmed across from me while I was eating a Universal cheeseburger was Britney Spears' Slave for You video.
And that's your favorite movie.
Oh, that is. Yeah. So it was perfect.
Yeah. That's great. Wow.
Yeah.
Great line. He's Mank walks on set of some new talkie movie they're making. Louis B. Mayer is sitting there. He walks on. That's when he goes up and talks to the trophy wife. What's her name?
Yeah.
I don't feel comfortable referring to her as the trophy wife.
Yeah, I want to know her real. She was an She's an actress.
Yeah.
Her name.
Marion Davies.
Marion Davies.
Yeah.
Marion Davies. Marion Davies. Yes.
So Mank shows up to. He's gonna basically say hi to Marion Davies. I think the director or Louis B. Mayer says to him, "Long night," and he says, "A short one, plagued by spirits." Because he's still drunk.
Yeah. that's good.
That's just a good line.
And
it makes sense because he's a writer, he just talks like that. And then another great line when his editor is upset that he's writing this crazy time-jumping narrative. And as he leaves, he's yelling at him. And then as he leaves, he says, "Write hard, aim low." That's good. I feel like that's something I want to take to heart. To be more prolific. Write hard, aim low. "This political dialogue party is delicious. I want it played at my funeral." Marion Davies is in the room. Mank's wife is there. They're all just having a big political discussion about Nazis and about socialism and communism and Upton Sinclair. And it moves like a bullet. It's just back and forth.
Yeah. That whole scene is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Just beautiful.
Yeah, that's a scene.
And it also introduces us to our next villain, who is kind of like the number two at MGM then. It's okay. We don't need to keep doing this with names. Yeah. This whole episode is just us trying to remember names.
Yeah, but that scene to me was so good, but also, like, again, to me, that's not for everybody. I think a lot of people are going to they don't care about stuff like that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really fast, and they don't make it. They don't hold your hand. It's just like, we're just gonna bullet through this. There's so many good ideas brought up. They don't dwell on them. They just go right through.
Like the whole sequence that follows with them walking through San Simeon past the monkey cages, and then you go and you see the elephants and the giraffes and everything. That long languid scene of them just talking, getting to know each other.
Yeah.
It's a really long scene.
It's great.
Tons of beautiful outdoor footage is so classic Hollywood.
Yeah, and it's William Randolph Hearst's house, San Simeon.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous, huge, exotic place with all the giraffes, with all that stuff. When I was reading about the, that's also because that's in Citizen Kane, that's Xanadu. That's where Citizen Kane ends up. So it's like to mirror Hearst's house is Xanadu in Citizen Kane. When I was reading about it, that was one of the things they said was accurate about the movie, is that his house was that ridiculous.
What people can do with money is ridiculous. Yeah. It's kind of disgusting.
Yeah. And then I said, Bill Nye! Because Bill Nye plays Upton Sinclair. It's like a very...
Oh, is that Bill Nye?
Yeah, Bill Nye. Oh, election bet montage. Chef's kiss, I said. So
the election bet montage is the one time the Fincher, at least once in every movie, pulls the gloves off and gives you a Fincher sequence, you know, that's like beautiful close-ups, like cut together. In this case, it was still old Hollywood because it was dissolving from
this
one to the other.
This definitely
and
felt like an old montage to me.
Like in The Social Network, when you have that bizarre tilt shift boating sequence, that still makes a lot of sense, actually, where they're the boat race. But in terms of people's goals and things like that, Liza and I were talking about it. But in this case, it also makes a lot of sense because the energy of that room and betting on who's going to win.
Yeah. Mank bets against
Republican McBody Pants.
And then it's just like that's his name. Just like a brief montage of just intensity of like the numbers coming in and everything. And close-ups on Mank, I think, too, like sweating, I believe.
Yeah. And drinks and drinks. This and that.
And then it's done. Yeah. And then it's like kind of over in a kind of low-key way. Like it didn't even have to happen. The montage didn't have to happen at all. It's just like thrown in. But it's great. I loved it. Phony newsreel. OMG, the parallels to today. The parallels.
I know.
Looking at it, it's like, well, that looks staged and I can't believe people would fall for that. If you'd have talked to me, I don't know, 4 years ago, I would have been like, that's ridiculous. No one would fall for that. Today, now I have no idea.
People absolutely are doing it constantly today.
Yeah.
Like on both and every side.
I think it's almost equally as obvious. I watched the French pun bit 4 times and I couldn't get it.
French pun bit?
Yeah. It's his brother who makes a pun to him before he leaves about a court case they're doing, and he made a pun in French, and like as he's leaving, he's getting in his car, he says these lines about this pun he made. So
yeah, like, I don't think there was
there's something there that I'm not getting.
Okay, well I read
the subtitles, like I was like, what am I missing here? And I think it's just that I don't speak French, I guess. That's why I don't get the actual words. So maybe someone watching, please explain. Please explain the pun. This is my last note, but it was the bit where Orson throws some stuff at Mank, and then Mank's like, actually, that's pretty good for the ending. Like, I thought that was a little cheat. That was too much. I was like, well, I'm sure that didn't really happen. And then I read about it later. That did happen, but at an earlier time, probably didn't inspire the scene.
I dig that idea, but like the dramatization of it, where like he's like, oh, actually, that's really good. He furiously starts writing, was a little over the top.
Yeah.
And especially for Fincher, because Fincher doesn't like to push
too
far over the top. I feel like he would have just been like, finished the conversation, then would have sat down and start writing.
Yeah.
Like as a real person.
They didn't get along, I guess.
No, well, I mean, even if the things that they said in the newsreels after winning...
Those are true, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the agreement in the beginning was that Mank wouldn't get credit, but then he realized he wrote the best thing he ever wrote, and he wanted credit. So they fought, and Orson eventually gave him half credit. And then it was nominated for like 8 Oscars or something, but it only won one, and it was best screenplay. And so they both won an Oscar. They both weren't there. So separately in their speeches, Orson Welles said, "He can kiss my half," which is great. And then Mank said something to the effect of, "I'm going to accept this.
I accept this award in the same spirit in which the screenplay was written in the absence of Mr. Welles."
That's my notes. And
love it.
That's how I feel about it. I think it's great. Grank.
I think it's great too. I think it's fantastic. The fact that Fincher's dad wrote it explains to me why he would choose such a very verbal screenplay. Although, to be fair, Social Network is wall-to-wall dialogue as well.
That's Aaron Sorkin.
Like, non-stop dialogue, but more visually oriented. That movie is more laid out to be visual, like, just in terms of, like, the amount of locations and the variety of locations and, like, the way things can be filmed and the set piece sequences. And, like, there's just a lot more, like, big set pieces in Social Network than there is in Mank. It's basically just long dialogue scenes.
Yeah.
And only one scene in Mank made me feel like I get it and I wish we were on to the next scene already. And the only one is when he comes in at the end and kind of like dresses down the entire dining room of people.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's just saying all this stuff. And maybe it's only because I already have seen Citizen Kane several times and know about it and everything that like I didn't need him to kind of tell me all the stuff that he put in Citizen Kane.
I kind of liked it, but also that there's no evidence that that happened. But when he threw up, that one point, at some point he did say, "Oh, don't worry, I threw up the wine," or something like that. That actually happened, but that's not great. In that room.
Where in the Fincher filmography, where would it fall?
Well, I'd have to look at the list of Fincher movies, but it's probably in the top 5. Fight Club and Social Network and Gone Girl are way up there for me.
Yeah, yeah. Me too, dude. Me too.
And then maybe Mank. I don't know. It might be up there or near there.
More than 7?
Oh, no. 7. 7's up there too. So it's probably, maybe it's 5. I have to look at all of them, but yeah.
Yeah. Before we get to the end and we're all worn out from answering questions, I'm going to do my hardest question first.
Okay.
Early in the movie Mank, a new writer, Joe, Herman's brother, comes to start work, and he goes into the writer's room, and they go, "Okay, we gotta go tell Louis B. the story." And they go in, and it's clear that they had never before discussed this movie, but like one writer starts talking about the first act, and then the next writer says, "So you and I have to go in right now to Louis B. Mayer's office.
Oh, no.
I have a site right here called Genre Generator. We're just going to do a quick 5 beater, you know, just like right. Introduction, first problem, second problem, third resolution."
Wow. Okay.
Ooh, we got sci-fi. We got sci-fi.
Sci-fi. Okay.
Yep. Sci-fi. Do you want to start?
A scientist who invents a way to live until you're 500 years old.
Right. And it's set in the near future.
Yeah.
So like everything looks kind of similar, except there's more holograms and things like that. And he is trying to decide whether or not he's going to give this technology to the corporation that funded the research, or if he's just going to hoard it to himself and kind of like fake his own death and take it with him and just live himself singularly for the next 500 years.
Yeah, but then he falls in love.
Ooh.
And he does live for another 50 years, and she's dying.
Right.
And he can't save her without letting everyone know that this technology exists.
Right. So what, yes, absolutely. When we talked about this earlier, sorry, Mr. Mayer, I got wrapped up in my colleague's telling of the story here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like he has to decide then between the woman that he loves and the technology that if the corporation got it in their hands, they would potentially use it to destroy everything. He's now lived 50 more years. People are astonished that his health is retained so well. He hasn't been sick a day in 50 years, all this stuff. He looks so young and youthful. He goes to her room, and she's at death's door. and his corporate sponsors are right outside, and they come, and he says, I just have to say goodbye. If you could just wait in the hall for one moment. He goes in, he leaves his corporate sponsors right on the other side of the door. They came because they know, they suspect that he has this technology on him, on his person at this moment. And he goes into the hospital room where he says, I just need one moment, just count on your watch, one moment, I'm just gonna go in. And...
I get so wrapped up in this moment, Mr. Mayor. He goes in, and he goes up to the woman that he loves, and...
He says, he leans over her.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Is this okay?
No, go ahead.
I know you wrote this beat in the room, but yeah. I just had to... He leans over her, and he says, do you trust me? And she says, I will always trust you. Mm-hmm. And we cut back to the hallway, where the men are pacing, and they're like, what's your watch say? And he says, it's been one moment. And they go in, and they look, and... The window is open, and they look out, and they see two bodies laying on the ground below, at the bottom of it's like they're the 20th story of the hospital, and they're like, oh my God, we gotta, maybe he has the formula on, and we gotta go, and you go, and they run out of the room to go check the bodies, and then our heroes slide out from underneath the bed, and he's holding his loved one, and she's still alive, and he's given her the dosage, but you look over, and her roommate's bed is now empty.
The corporate people run out. They use that time to escape. They go to paradise. They find paradise and they fall in love. But she is so upset that he threw the roommates out of the window. So he tells her he's going to go back. He's going to find the bodies. His technology can bring them back from the dead.
His serum, yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't know it until now, Mr. Mayor. Yeah. We didn't know as an audience, not as the writers who are coming into you with a story we've developed, but as the audience, we didn't know that the serum could also revive the dead.
Only after a certain amount of time. Only after a certain amount of
time. Yeah. So he has to race back to try and get there in time. Mm-hmm. Except guess what? It's not true. That's a lie. He just had to get out of town long enough so that his loved one would die and not steal his technology.
Yep, that's right, Mr. Mayor. I feel after a lot of arguments about the ending, Jake won. I think we're onto something there, though. That's pretty good.
Anytime it was my story, it got worse and worse and worse.
Well, I don't think he had to. It could have been brought back at the end, but no. I feel like that's an easy fix, though. That's an easy fix. Greatest black and white film noir of all time.
For me, I enjoy the film To Have and Have Not, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
That's their chemistry is red hot.
Unbelievable. Red and hot. It's their first one together. Yeah. It's their first one together. So you're really seeing them fresh.
I think after they shot that, Humphrey Bogart left his wife for her.
Correct. It's a real Mr. and Mrs. Smith situation.
Also, if you watch Casablanca and then you watch To Have and To Have Not, and you compare the relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
Between Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, and then Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Yeah, chemistry's way better in To Have and Have Not.
Yeah.
Way better.
The chemistry's great. The dialogue's great. Like, it's just, the photography's great. It is beautiful, beautiful film.
I'm not saying I like one more than the other. It's just that the chemistry in To Have and Have Not is insane.
I feel similarly about Casablanca as I do about Citizen Kane.
Wow. I think Casablanca's great. But third. Oh, you wanted to guess mine.
I knew it was. You already said it. Third Man. I knew. Yeah. Like, because we went. We saw it at the Music Box. We went to a screening of that.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Third Man. Love it. Orson Welles didn't direct, but he's in it, and he's not even the star of it. But I don't know. Just love it. There are moments in that remind me of the Coen Brothers, and the soundtrack is a zither.
My next question: favorite movie, Craig? Favorite movie about writing?
Yeah, you asked me to answer this, and I thought about it for a while, and I looked at lists, and I came up with what I think is my number one, and then I have a couple runners up. Well, for me, I chose this one because it's the one that I, out of my all of my three, was that I feel like I would just want to watch right now. Like, I could watch it again. And that is Wonder Boys.
That's my number one movie about writing of all time. Yep, that's my number one. Wonder Boys.
Wow.
It is the best movie about writing. Like, it's what it feels like to be talking to writers about writing. It's what it feels like to be writing something good, something that you care about. It's what it feels like to be writing something that you feel like isn't working. Like,
it's what it feels like to be in a creative writing class, which I've been in several. Like, at the beginning, they're in a creative writing class.
Yeah.
Like, it feels, it actually really does feel like writing.
Curtis Hanson's follow-up to L.A. Confidential, Michael Douglas, Robert Downey Jr., Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire, Katie Holmes. Like, it's just such a good, Frances McDormand. Oof, what a cast. Such a good movie. Such a good movie.
And then my runners-up were Barton Fink and Capote.
Barton Fink, man. That's my screenwriting one. And and so much of Mank also reminded me of Barton Fink.
Yeah,
it just feels it's that same era.
Old Hollywood.
Yeah, same era, same Hollywood vibe.
I'm amazed that we both chose Wonder Boys. That's amazing to me. Wow,
great movie.
Could have chosen so many different movies. What's another movie there should be a movie made about?
Right, making of a movie about a making of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time with this one, and I came down to two. My choice between two. One would be fairly easy to research. There's so much about the making of it already. You might as well dramatize the making of it, and that's Jaws.
Okay.
All right, you got the young wunderkind director. A lot of things working against him. And you could also have a lot of points of entry from that. It's probably not just a single perspective film. You'd probably have to be a fly on the wall of a lot of conversations in that one. Second one, real nitty gritty, and almost probably would be more fun because before people are making studio movies, it's when they really have their craziest stories. The making of Evil Dead in 1979.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Down in Tennessee.
So my choice is Heaven's Gate.
Oh, wow.
The Michael Camino coming off of Deer Hunter. And it is the notorious example of going over budget and destroying a studio. And I see so many stories about how there's this Western that he just kept getting bigger and bigger and was incredibly expensive. And it was a horrible flop.
Yeah.
But there's stories about ridiculous things he did on set, like, he insisted they shoot a battle scene 3 hours away from their home base. So they would have to drive 3 hours to go shoot this battle. He had an irrigation system set up for plant life and grass or whatever in a scene. Like, he had to grow grass for a scene. He had minimum 32 takes on everything or something. Like, that was, like, required. Like, he had to do multiple takes. I want to see a movie about that.
Yeah. Who is, or what character is your favorite trophy wife in cinema?
All right, so I think she's a trophy wife, but I mean,
I think we're just gonna say the same thing again.
We probably are.
One, two, three. Tara Reid,
Uma Thurman, Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
Can you give your best drunk acting by saying this line? I just wrote a random line.
Okay.
Random,
what'd you get?
Sentence. Here, let me send it to you. Hey, oh, you're costuming up.
Yeah, getting into character here. Yeah,
I better too. I got a bottle here.
Ready?
Yeah. Hey, man. How's it going?
Just living life like a good man should, so don't give me any guff.
All right. Good. You're still in character. You're still doing it. Wow. Okay. all right. Now it's my turn.
Yeah.
Do it.
Oh. Hey, man. How's it going?
Just living life like a good man should. Don't give me any guff.
See, that's good. You're deeply drunk at that point.
Well, I'm just really tired.
Yeah. You're so drunk, you're exhausted.
You were just real sloppy.
Yeah, I was a sloppy drunk.
Was that it? Was that all the questions?
Yeah, that's the six. I've done my three. Did you do your three? Yeah. Yeah,
you did my three.
So thank you for joining us again for another episode of Movied. I am Jake.
I am Jake's friend.
Oh, yeah, guys. You know what we never, ever do? You guys could go subscribe on Spotify. That would help. You could go to Apple Podcasts and just leave us a review and a rating. If you're just listening to us, you could go check out the video version of this on Wheezy News.
Or just call your family or your friends and say hi.
Yeah. Don't even bring up the podcast. Just talk to your friends and family.
Yeah. But social distance, just call them. Yeah. Don't go see them.
No.
And... scene.
Movie.
I just realized, should this entire episode have been in black and white?
Ooh. I like it.
So, guess what, guys? This episode was in black and white. Whoa, surprise! For the podcast listeners, it is a surprise.